Welcome to Between the Margins on CHRW Radio 94.9 FM. I'm Michelle Boyce, and Gio this week is running our production studio for the first time, so big cheer goes up for Gio on that one. So it's just me, and I have special in-studio guest, Dr. Meredith Frazier. She loves that doctor. Hi, Meredith.
Hi, Michelle.
And we have an interview with Dr. Eric Fisher, who is a psychologist, got his degree out of Ohio, and he's going to be talking to us a little bit later. And we have Robin Wing, who received some disturbing emails, and we got a short message from him as well. So this is an interesting show that we have going here. You know, it's Easter weekend coming up, so resurrection is the theme, and hopefully this show will resurrect some viewpoints on bullying, adult bullying, free speech versus human rights, the left versus the right, and who's fallen off of the edge. Okay, so Meredith, you're with LUSO Community Services, and you want to tell us your position with that?
Absolutely. I work as the program coordinator for the anti-hate and anti-bias program at LUSO. So my role there is to support people that have experienced or witnessed hate, bias, or discrimination in any form through advocacy or referrals. Also to help raise community awareness about hate and bias issues, and obviously to develop and implement some strategies in collaboration with community partners that are aimed at reducing these incidents and making sure that our community remains, you know, safe for everyone.
Great. And you also run a hotline, or you support a hotline.
Absolutely. We help manage a hate helpline. It's a service where people can call and report experiences of hate, bias, and discrimination. It's confidential. It's voluntarily anonymous. It's operators are answering 9 to 5 Monday to Friday, but people can leave a message. And the number for that is 519-951-1584.
Great. And we'll have that on websites and everywhere for you. And there's a new program called Report Homophobic Violence, period, coming on May 17th with HBT Working Group launching that in conjunction with us and CHRW Radio and Diversity Training Live and all of our partners at the table and LUSO. Mm-hmm. So everybody's got to look forward to that and see more about that coming up. So, you know, the City of London has got a lot of programs that cover these issues.
Absolutely. We have a great network of community partners in London that address all kinds of hate, bias, and discrimination related issues and offer support. So the HBT Working Group, as you've mentioned, is one that brings together people who are concerned with issues around homophobia, biphobia, and transphobia specifically. So again, lots of people represented there: the AIDS Committee, the London Middlesex Health Unit, Westerns, Fanshawe, LUSO, the Cross Cultural Learner Centre. Those are just a few of the London Police Service, just a few of the community partners involved there. So yes, we have a great support network in our community.
And then we brought Ann Coulter to London, and we're going to talk a little bit about that. Mm-hmm. And more about the free speech society that brought Ann Coulter here, because that's more relevant to our Canadian human rights scene and free speech versus Ann Coulter, who is, conservative right-wing extremist in the States, and I'm not really sure what she has to add to Canada's arguments.
Certainly, her arrival here has sparked a lot of debate around speech, hate speech, free speech, all different types of speech, and certainly it's been a bit of a catalyst for those discussions. So, of course, as we were talking a bit earlier, you know, the issue moves beyond, you know, her representation here, but into these larger issues that as a nation we have to talk about.
And some of those issues are the methodology. And that's more what I want to talk about on this show than the players. And the methodology seems to run bullying. And there's this akin to bullying, adult bullying, that these groups use. The Western student, Fatima, who stood up and asked the question of Ann Coulter, you know, everybody has heard about, she said that I don't have a flying carpet. So method do you expect me to use for flying if I can't fly on airlines as a Muslim woman? And Ann Coulter, of course, in her usual, I don't have a real answer, said, well, use your camel, of course, you know, which spurred a lot of controversy.
Sure, and it's not unexpected. Ann Coulter is polemical. She's there to incite debate, to create controversy. It's part of, I think, a broader marketing strategy. That's what people go to see. That's what people, you know, she's paid to do. $15,000, I believe, is some of the.
I think it was $10,000 per.
Sure.
Show plus expenses.
Yeah. So it's something in that neighborhood. Various prices have been quoted. So, you know, that's part of her role, right? And so it's not altogether unexpected that we would have these kind of comments from her in this particular case. We can, of course, talk about their appropriateness, but certainly not unexpected to hear Ann Coulter make a statement like that.
Absolutely. And what is really, really troubling for me as a radio host is that for the first time ever, I have had more declines of people to come on this show and talk about this topic than I have ever received with any other show we've done. And the reason is, like Fatima, she wouldn't come on because she's receiving hate mail. She's being, you know, singled out. She's being bullied. She's being intimidated. And she just wants this to go away. And that's the same thing that I'm getting from lawyers, from professionals. And they just don't want to throw their hand into this debate, because if they do, they're going to get swamped with this anti-Semitism mail, all of this hate and all of this violence. I mean, Richard Warman, you know, has received, you know, threats against his children, his wife, you know, his first daughter, born daughter. He gave a different name than his to protect her from the hate groups that have been threatening. And I think that is the big issue here is, you know, we talk about free speech and we talk about having intellectual arguments. And all of that is awesome. And I will have an intellectual argument with anybody on any topic without calling them names.
Absolutely. I think you point out two key issues here. One is the issue of intimidation or bullying. We can see parallels between strategies that are used by certain communities, in this case, right-wing conservative, such as self-identified right-wing conservatives, to discourage people who are not who do not share those views from participating in public debates or forums. And the other is just sort of the consequences of that for an individual. And it really sheds light into how bullying works, right? We see it, whether we see it in the schoolyard or we see it in a place of work or we see it in the public forum. People are often reluctant to report incidences of violence, hate-motivated incidents. And the reason why, or one of the key reasons why, is fear. And that, of course, allows these incidents to continue. And this is an example of how that works, right? This is just another expression of that cycle, right?
Exactly. And one example of that is an email that was sent by Kathy Shadle, who she's one of the directors of Free Press Society that brought Ann Coulter here. And in this email that was blanketed spam to everybody that was in attendance, she says, you know, things like, well, there's a lot of things. When we talk about free speech, I'm a radio host, okay? And I have an email here in front of me with a whole bunch of language that I would love to tell you about that I can't use on the air. So, you know, she talks a lot about the fuzzy bunny. And you know, she talks, as usual, she's bashing the gays, she's bashing everything. But, you know, one of the quotes that I can say here is, "Dear idiots, will you be displaying similar bravery the next time Muslim students and their brain-dead infidel fart catchers spread blood libels against the Jews on your campus? I won't be holding my CO2. Now, this is from Kathy Shadle, and this was before Ann Coulter ever stepped foot in Canada that she sent this out. So, you know, it was already set up against the Muslims. And this one of the people that this email went to is a gentleman named Robert Wing, and we have a few of his comments now.
all I can say is I was very shocked, angry, hurt, and a little bit threatened when I received this email. I just really don't see how it fits into any civilized discussion, free speech or not. You should be civilized, even when you're delivering your free speech. There's clearly some sort of prejudice or anger involved here that really this woman, Kathy, needs to address. I launched a complaint to the London police and the campus police. I showed both of them the email. Unfortunately, nothing happened as a result of that. And I hope we can, I guess, just take a moral lesson out of this and oppose hate speech, I guess. Not limit free speech, but say there are some things that, civilized people just don't say to each other because it hurts. There are words that hurt, and that hurt can sometimes inspire violence. And everyone has the right to speak their mind freely, but also everyone has the right to show up to work or to school without having to face speech that makes them feel very threatened at a very physical level. So I think we really need to separate free speech from the freedom to be able to show up on campus and not feel attacked and threatened.
And that was Robin Wing, who... You know, he had nothing to do with anything. He did attend the Ann Coulter thing, and he was on the attendance list, and he went as a gay male who was extremely offended by it, of course. But he didn't put up any websites. He didn't do anything. He didn't speak out against the right. He didn't speak out against Ann Coulter. Yet he wakes up at 6 o'clock in the morning, Monday morning, and opens his mail, and this is what he has there.
Absolutely. It certainly is obviously intimidating. It's fear-mongering. It's really infringing on, again, as Robin mentions, our right as people to enjoy life free from violence, to enjoy life free from experiencing a hate or and that kind of thing. And I think what often gets a bit conflated here is sort of free speech and the right to just say anything without regard of how things are expressed. So certainly there should be a place for expressing disparate opinions, to have healthy debates, to express polemical views, but always within a language that's appropriate and non-offensive and respectful. I think that's part of what needs to happen. And certainly there's a lot of discussion around how that might look and how that takes place. But I don't necessarily think a comment about the tone of language or type of language that's used is necessarily an infringement or always an infringement on someone's free speech. I think that we can certainly should expect that people speak, again, with respect to one another.
Absolutely. And like my son, who's in grade 10, put it, oh, I learned all about this in civics class. You know, free speech, that's the right. And, you know, speaking respectfully, that's the responsibility. You know, my 10 or my 15-year-old son's got it down pat. I mean, where are the adults in this? So a few miles behind. Well, we did talk to an expert on all of this, the left, the right, and the bullying. And here's that interview now.
Dr. Fisher.
Hi, Dr. Fisher. It's Michelle Boyce calling from Between the Margins. How are you?
I'm good.
Calling you in regards to some incidents we had up here in Canada. I'm not sure if you're following the Ann Coulter situation.
Oh, I'm aware, but I just need to apologize for my fellow Americans. I'm so sorry.
Well, we don't want to give her any more airtime than she's already had, but it struck me that there's a group, both in Canada and in the United States, that tend to bully the North American population to get their point across. So I wanted to talk to you about that a little bit. But first off, I wanted to introduce you to our audience. And like Ann Coulter, you have a couple of books that you've written.
Right.
The most relevant one, I think, to this conversation is The Art of Managing Everyday Conflict and the Relationship Between Power and Emotion.
Mm-hmm.
And you're also an expert on bullying, as I understand it.
Yeah. And that has a lot to do with the way we look at power and emotion and the roles that we play in our culture. actually. And when we understand the roles we play and why we play them, it really makes it easy to figure out why we do what they do.
Right. And that's what we want to talk about. And now, can you tell everybody your credentials?
Yeah, I'm a licensed psychologist. I have private practice out of the state of Georgia. I've been doing media consulting for about a decade now. And I work with kids as young as 2 to adults as old as 62. I work with families and couples. And I really enjoy my work. I love what I do. And to me, the most important thing when you start out working with people is to make sure you have a common language. And that common language that we all have is power, no matter what language we talk. We have to understand that our common language across the world really is power in the way we look at it. And when people really understand that we're really not that different, you know, I would say we all feel the same emotions as what we do with them that makes us different. That often helps us to really navigate conflicts much more successfully than feel like we're going blind and feel like nobody understands us when they really have the tools to understand each other.
Exactly. And when you're dealing with these issues, I mean, they seem to be pretty global, and I don't think there's a Canadian or an American context. I mean, in Canada, we have the Free Speech Society, which has, you know, Ezra Levant and Margaret Wente and Mark Stein and Kathy Schadl, that group of people. And, you know, in the States, you have the REB Network and the Republican Engine that goes there. So the liberalism versus the conservative battle, I don't think it's all that different between the two countries.
No, I don't. Even if you looked a little bit in recent history, you remember the conflict that happened in the Russian parliament when actually a fistfight broke out not too many years ago. And, you know, you can find many, many pockets around the world and, you know, in political histories and things that even religious histories, you know, you look at the battles within the Catholic Church and the, you know, within the Lutheran Church, they split between the LCA and the ALC over issues that were in some ways they made big things out of things that were all small because, you know, aren't we all here to learn to treat each other with respect and honor and dignity? So that's the irony is the way we go about doing that is often with a sledgehammer.
So maybe you can fill me in, because I've always had this difficult time connecting why the conservatives find it necessary to attack marginalized groups. I mean, I don't understand that part of conservatism.
Well, I really gave it some good thought, you know, overnight and really tried to figure some of that out, too, and, you know, because what are the traits of people who are more conservative? Well, if you think in warlike ways, and let me back up a little bit. Let me start to explain the whole way we look at power, and I think then I can kind of get in that kind of conservative versus liberal discussion. The way we look at power in our culture is in what I call a hierarchical or control-based system. You think of everybody as a different size circle. You have the big circle all the way down to the little circle and all the circles in between, and that really would define our power. It can be defined by status, which comes with age. It comes with intelligence. It comes with strength. It comes with political prowess. It comes with military might, religious aspects. How good am I at schmoozing my way through things? I mean, those are all different levels of status, and we're all often looking for status to increase our perception of power. Now, in that model of power, I say that there are 4 dichotomies. And the dichotomies means the state of cutting things into 2. So hot and cold, black and white would be dichotomy. The 4 that I say operate under the hierarchical model are good and bad, right and wrong, strong and weak, and win and lose. And when we understand and look at just those 4 dichotomies, you can see why conflict becomes so contentious is because it's between one or the other. There aren't really any in between. And the other issue is that people really don't, in a hierarchical model, want to have the same amount of power as anybody because we all want to see ourselves as unique, and we measure our uniqueness through our amount of power, whether it be more or less than the other. So when we start to look at those dichotomies, well, the ultimate one is whether or not I won or lost. It's the secondary ones you have to look at. So if we now kind of back up and look at our conservative versus liberal, conservatives overall, I would say, tend to want to be seen as strong versus weak. Liberals are more likely to want to be seen as good versus bad. So a liberal one might want to be more likely to want to look good. The conservative wants to look strong. Well, the reason why we fight wars across the world is to look strong. Because if I look strong and I win, then I increase the chances of being able to find what's good and what's right in that culture. Now, in our history in the United States, you know, we have the Hawks versus the Doves. That goes all the way back to the Revolutionary War and around there in the Civil War, where you have the groups that were called the Hawks that were more warlike. They tend to be the more conservative side that say, we have to handle this problem. We got to take care of it now. We got to control it. So even in there, conservatives might be more control-seeking. And a lot of cultures that tend to be more dominant tend to be more control-seeking. So those are the ones that potentially become more dominant, where you could argue that your liberals might tend to say, let's see how things work out. We have our agenda here, but we're not necessarily going to go head-to-head. We'll work it out. We'll go the political routes. Well, the normal political routes sometimes take a little longer than some people want to take, who want answers now and don't necessarily have the patience. Okay.
So this is very similar to the old Aboriginal issue within Aboriginal cultures versus European culture, whereby the Aboriginals, when they wanted to, they were more consensus-managed organization, whereby when they had a problem, all of the elders got into a circle, and they all sat there and they used I statements, and I feel that this is the way that this is. And then they'd go on to the next elder, and they'd go around and around in the circles until the I statement started coming to consensus, and then they'd have their decision. Versus the European concept, where they sit on a circle and they finger point across the circle and say, you're wrong, this is the way you should see it. So is that kind of the thing you're talking about?
Yeah, it's how we get there. It's the next piece of this model are the roles that we play. So we have the dichotomies, and now the next piece is the roles, and this is really, it helps to explain a lot, is that the first role that we play, that people play in a hierarchical culture, is the victim. The victim is the person that something happens to. So when something happens to them, they didn't do anything, nothing's their fault. If it's not their fault, then there's no blame, no shame, no guilt, no failure, no responsibility. I'm off the hook. The next role is the persecutor. The persecutor we call a bully. Their role is that they cause the victim pain. And they cause the victim pain, why? Because they wanted to have power over somebody. And when they cause that pain, they try to evoke fear out of the victim so they can gain control. The next role is the rescuer. The rescuer is supposed to have the most power. And the rescuer wants to take care of the victim, and also they enjoy crushing the persecutor sometimes. Not all the time. Some rescuers just want to take care of the victims and don't want it to happen again. But depending on the rescuer and their makeup, they might want to be the one who wants to ride in on their horse and vanquish the other army and lay waste in their thing and say, look what I've done to help save you. Now, in these roles that are played, there's three games that I say are played. The victim plays the how much do you love me game, the persecutor plays the how much do you fear me game, and the rescuer plays the how much do you worship me game. Now, most politicians tend to be what I call chronic rescuers. In other words, they come to fix a problem, they're going to solve that problem, and they want to solve that problem the right way. Now, they're always rescuing the victims, so they're representing their constituents. However, if they're going up against the other party, the other party's going to see them as the persecutor. So I would say one man's bully is another man's rescuer. And what happens in this situation is you have to then back up and look at the dichotomy. A victim has to be seen as good and right, but weak. In other words, I didn't do anything wrong, I didn't do anything bad, but I can't protect myself, so somebody needs to come take care of me. The persecutor has to be seen as strong, but they don't care about being seen as good or right until they define that they've won. Then when they define that they've won, like I said, then they can define what's good and right. Say, you know, give me your lunch money every day, and that's the right way we're going to do things. And the rescuer has to be seen as good and strong and right. So politically, if I can attack my opponents and find out every way that they're bad and wrong, they can no longer be seen as a rescuer. But me, I don't necessarily point out how I'm wrong, I point out how I'm right and how you're wrong. So again, I'm the rescuer, I'm good and strong and right, and you're doing all these things that are bad and wrong. And that's one of the keys that goes on in this whole thing of bullying, is a bully rarely sees himself as a bully. I mean, Ann Coulter has probably been called a bully many times. She'll go, I'm not a bully, I'm trying to represent the political right. This is what needs to happen. This is the right thing. We're trying to help people and save people from the villainous liberals who are destroying our culture. So it's all how you twist reality to define your truth, and if it doesn't work, then it becomes more contentious, and it becomes more power hungry, and it becomes more about being strong versus truly right. And that's really what I see going on right now.
And up here in Canada, we have these things called the Human Rights Commissions. Are you familiar with that concept?
No, not.
The Human Rights Commissions, we have 12 of them, and their position is that they can bring legislation against people who are marginalizing people because of their identity. And that's the war that is raging in Canada right now. The Free Speech Society is attacking the Human Rights Commissions because they say that these commissions are inhibiting their ability to say what they want to say, and therefore they're inhibiting free speech. And so they would be our rescuers in your model,
right,
whereby they defend the individual victim,
right,
in a legal context, and then they can put penalties on the persecutor, and monetary penalties is basically the only compensation that they have. So up in Canada, we have the conservatives who want to abolish the human rights commissions in this country, and that's the war that's being waged here.
And that's what we have to be careful of, is in the hierarchical models of power, we get our power from other people. The victim gets it from the rescuer, the persecutor gets it from crushing the victim, the rescuer gets it from crushing the persecutor and rescuing the victim. One of the discussions I heard Ann Coulter have with, I believe it was Joy Behar, was she was commenting on how everybody who buys her book must like her. And Joy Behar was like, people don't say like your book because they like you. She goes, you know, well, Rush Limbaugh has 20 million listeners, so all those people must want to listen to him. And that's not necessarily the case, and it doesn't mean that you have all these constituents and all these people. One of the problems with adult bullies, we think in an adult culture that we stand up for ourselves and speak more, but a lot of people still go along feeling like the victims they felt like when they were kids because they never really learned how to handle conflict. So they kind of keep their mouth shut rather than having some of these abrasive people come attack them. It doesn't mean they agree with them. And it doesn't mean they want to be rescued. They just don't want to cause the problem because they don't want to be singled out or, you know, or bullied more. And that's what really leads the culture to really being more of a dictatorship and becoming more controlling, is because the people who don't speak up should speak up. And that's a real danger. And probably you'd find that category of more liberals, because they want to be seen as good, aren't necessarily likely to stir the pot as much because they just want peace in those situations.
Well, that's very similar to what happened here in London, Ontario at UWO. A young Muslim girl quoted back Ann Coulter's hate message against Muslims and the flying carpet quote, and asked her, since I don't have a flying carpet, what mode of transportation would you suggest? To which Ann Coulter replied in her usual manner that, well, take your camel, of course.
Wow. And in there you see these glorious stereotypes that people use to justify and judge their action, whatever their cause may be. And that's the real problem in our culture, too, is judgment. And I always say that judgment isn't based in truth. Judgment is based in usually a few points of observation. Then we draw a line through from one point to the other point. And based on whichever points we choose, you know, we can choose our own points to draw through. That's then going to define our truth. And it's incomplete. And it doesn't allow for evolution. It doesn't allow for growth. It doesn't allow for change. And then we have ignorance. And then what happens is we end up having a lot of ignorant people making choices for us. And because they're louder and because they scream more, people almost accept that if you scream louder and the other person doesn't scream back, well, you must be right. And that's just not the way it is. It's just some people just don't really want to play that game.
And that's the young Muslim woman that made that comment has become the center of the hate mail and the attack mechanisms that the conservatives are using. And she's declined to come on this show because, in her words, she just hopes this goes away.
Right. And that's a shame. Because, you know, you have people out there who didn't do anything but speak up, and then they just get destroyed, and they don't have the desire, the strength, the skills to really support themselves. And then potentially they get somebody who starts speaking for them who's really not speaking for them. They're speaking for themselves. That's kind of where you get a lot of attorneys out there say, well, I'm going to come help you. I'm going to come rescue you. But it really becomes the attorney's cause, or it becomes the political party's cause. And then that's how you get martyrs. Martyr is a victimized rescuer. It's somebody that says, I came to do this and this and this for you, and what have you done for me? And if we can hold that martyr up as our cause, as the center of our cause, then we can get the power of the people behind us. Again, it's not really about truth. It's about evoking emotion.
We are all in this together, brothers and sisters. We can do better.
And we're back. My name's Michelle Boyce, and I have Meredith Frazier from LUSO with me, and that was the first half of Dr. Eric Fisher's interview. The second half of that is coming up shortly, but wanted to cut into the middle there and talk about some of the stuff that he had, and talk about my own personal story, because when we talk about this bullying, I had a human rights case myself 3 years ago with the Canadian Human Rights Commission, and I had a doctor that discriminated against me, and I put forward my case, and while I was testifying and on the stand, an article came out in the Globe and Mail by Margaret Wente, and we were on a three-week recess while I was on the stand, which meant I couldn't by law speak about any of the case or anything. So I was in a position which I don't find myself very often, and that is I couldn't verbally defend myself. And the experience of being silenced while you were reading horrible things in the Globe and Mail about you by Margaret Wente, and Ezra Levant picked it up, and Mark Stein published on it, and the bloggers started blogging across the international blogs and picking it up. And, you know, there, most of the article was lies. I mean, they said that I had a cushy government job, and I was a privileged individual, and why was I attacking this predominant doctor and everything, which was totally untrue. I've never had a government position, although I keep sending in resumes, but I'd love to have one of those. But it totally and completely demoralized me, because A, I was silenced, and B, it was totally and completely a mission to demoralize me, and they were personal attacks about me and the size of my hands and my teeth and my crackling voice. And, you know, it was just brutalizing personal attacks against me. It wasn't an intellectual argument about my case before the tribunal.
And that seems to be, I think, symptomatic of these cases when or these the way that these things unfold, right? That issues that could be debated rationally, intellectually, respectfully become personalized, and then people at the center of them are targeted, and that may be through a variety of things, whether it's through articles, whether it's through emails, as in the case of Robin Wing, again, who wasn't even sort of at the center of what was unfolding here. And it's a tactic, right? And it's effective. And you know, as Dr. Fisher pointed out, it's about, you know, how people choose to handle emotion and about judgment. And I think it's really effective as a strategy, fear, that is. And it keeps people, again, from speaking out. And that silencing is really powerful. And it also happens, I think, a phrase that if anyone knows me well, they know that I really don't like the phrase political correctness, because I feel that it's often used as a silencing strategy, as a way to dismiss legitimate observations or concerns. And so, again, these sort of attacks or these strategies are mobilized in a variety of ways. In this case, in sharing your personal experience, you know, you've pointed out how that can happen in media, in different media institutions, and depending on our circumstances, we're more or less able to respond. You know, again, if you're under a court order not to speak about a case, you know, there's very little you can do in that moment, at least for that amount of time, to be able to present any kind of view to counter what's been how you've been represented, which is an issue. You know, it's a problem in terms of how the system unfolds.
Yeah, and my rescuer at that point was Chief Commissioner Barbara Hall, who attempted to put in letters to the editor and things like that in my defense, and which they wouldn't publish, of course. You know, they were out to get the kangaroo courts. So my rescuer was unsuccessful. Mm-hmm. But, you know, so many rescuers are. And I mean, that is what this, you know, hate campaign that they're calling free speech is all about. You know, like Dr. Fisher said, you know, they've got to point out where the commissions are wrong and unjust so that they can dismantle the system that is persecuting them as the persecutor. Mm-hmm. So, you know, that talks immensely to the whole campaign that's going on against the Human Rights Commissions by the Free Speech Society.
Sure, I think you know, I think Dr. Fisher's right on in the sense that, you know, it's a really nice model, you know, this idea of the different roles that we might take on in a given scenario, victim, you know, persecutor and rescuer, and that it's really a matter of perception. Any one of us can take on any of those roles. It kind of depends where we are positioned within a given debate and how that looks, you know, and it's really interesting how we mobilize these different roles to achieve particular ends, you know, regardless of how we're fitting into a particular debate or issue.
Right. Peter Randall, in his research in 1991, Adult Bullying and Perpetrator and Victims, he puts adult bullying as bullying is the aggressive behavior arising from the deliberate intent to cause physical or psychological distress to others. You know, that pretty much sums it up as far as what the campaigns that are going on are trying to do. They're trying to cause psychological distress to others. There's physical threats against people to threaten and intimidate others. And I just in comparison, I pulled a little clip off of YouTube, and CBS correspondent Harry Smith talks with adolescent psychologist Dr. Jennifer Hartstein. This is just a short clip.
Bullying is a very big problem at schools across the country. 23% of students in grades 4 to 6 have been bullied several times or more, while 20% admit to being the bully. Here with advice on what parents can do is child psychologist Dr. Jennifer Hartstein. Good morning.
Good morning.
Those numbers are amazing.
They're
it's
staggering.
Not just scattered, isolated incidents. It's a good fifth or more of kids
absolutely.
Who are victims or are bullies themselves.
Yes, absolutely. It's happening. It's pervasive. And in a funny way, bullying behavior is happening a lot. We all have done it at some point,
mm-hmm.
but this is really when it's happening in an ongoing way with real intention to hurt the other person.
All right. If you become aware that your child is acting the bully, boy or girl, doesn't matter, you've got some advice and things that you really need to act on.
Mm-hmm.
And among the things you say is don't allow excuses.
Absolutely. It's so often that our kids come home, but it wasn't my fault. I didn't do it. He did this to me. Really encourage them to take responsibility for what their role was in this.
Mm-hmm.
Encourage the sentences to start with I did this when he did this to me, and then you can really encourage taking personal responsibility and accountability for their actions.
You also say that you need to identify the causes. What's at root of this? What can you learn then if you identify the
right.
causes?
Well, if you know why kids are bullying, and we often focused on the targets
mm-hmm.
in our topic, so it's so important to focus on the bullies themselves
right.
because they are equally at risk for things. 25% of the kids who bully are in jail or have criminal records by the time they're 30.
Wow.
So we want to look at this. So we want to think about, is it just their temperament?
Mm-hmm.
A lot of bullies tend to not read social cues well, not have that empathy
Mm.
card that other people have.
Right.
Have they learned it from somewhere? Bullying is a learned
sure.
behavior. Do they observe it that their parents use power to get what they want?
Mm-hmm.
So the kids learn power.
Right.
And also, oftentimes, so many times we can pull it apart and say, kids are bullying to feel power, feel accepted, and to work on their self-esteem. They
right.
have self-esteem issues, too.
Mm. Discuss bullying behavior. That's what you really were just talking
yes.
about there. But in the end, you've really got to enforce consequences.
Yes.
You've got to lay down the law.
You do. You have to be the person in control. So if you say to them, these behaviors are really not acceptable in our house, there's no name-calling,
mm-hmm.
there's no fighting, there's none of these things, there's no excluding your friends because you just don't like them today,
right.
which is a different kind of bullying.
Mm.
We have to say, if that happens, here's the consequences. And here's the behavior that I expect from you.
Right.
And start to reinforce that behavior.
Mm.
If you reinforce the positives,
right.
they'll really know what to expect and what you want.
And that, you know, talks to bullying as a whole and the bully. And this is what we expect of our children. And across the nation, we have anti-bullying programs that are coming. We're pounding this issue with our children. You've got to be nice. You can't disrespect others. You can't intimidate. You can't bully. You can't fearmonger. You can't do all of these things. And this is what we're teaching our children across the nation, and we've recognized this as a social problem. Yet, the kids go and look at the Free Speech Society, who are saying, I should be able to say anything that I want, whenever I want, however I want, against whoever I want. So how is this disconnect useful?
Certainly it would seem that it's a hypocritical message, right? That we expect our children to be respectful of one another, you know, to not engage in bullying behavior, to report bullying when it happens, to be an active bystander, to examine their roles in the bullying process, to be critically reflexive and to respond appropriately. And as you mentioned, that then we see adults arguing for our right to be able to express ourselves, under the guise of free speech, or calling it free speech, as you say, you know, however we want as adults, whenever we want, in whatever language, to whomever. And certainly there's a disconnect, as you say right there. that I find particularly interesting. What I liked about that particular clip too was that it throws the focus on the bully. Bullies bully because it gives them certain things. And so often in programming, we look at those who are targeted, which we must do, and we certainly must support those who are targeted. But we need to take a holistic approach. We also need to understand the motivation behind the bullying, because only by doing that can we understand how to prevent it from happening. And I think that holds true. It's about, for adults, you know, taking a holistic view. Why are people acting and engaging the way they do? What are the agendas or motivations? And then how do we proceed from there in terms of addressing the issues?
Exactly. And, you know, that's just so true with everything that we have and all of the programs that we put into place on all of these issues. And the Human Rights Commissions play that rescuer role. And my hope is that as this anti-bullying education roots in the schools, then it's going to become less and less of an issue when people become adults. And again, in Peter Randall's research, he says, given the roots of adult bullying seem to be firmly established in childhood, it is therefore necessary to understand what sort of children the adult bullies were in order to trace the developing role of positive reinforcement as their destiny unfolds.
I think it's important, too, on that note, to recognize that these behaviors are learned behaviors, so they're not inherent within a person. They're not, people are sort of inherently neither good nor bad. I think, you know, sort of people are people, and we learn these behaviors. So, again, early intervention is key. I'd be reluctant to say someone's a good child or a bad child or a certain kind of child, but certainly we make behavioral choices that, you know, have positive or negative consequences in a given system. And again, starting early in terms of teaching about human interactions and how to be respectful and why that's important would go a long way. As you mentioned earlier, you know, your son in his civics class knows that part of being a responsible citizen of a nation is to learn how to be respectful and to interact with people appropriately. And I find that particularly important, given that a lot of the rhetoric that is used by people who are advocating free speech, particularly sort of on the far right spectrum, is that it's there's often sort of a nationalistic, that this is a threat to our national identity or our national democracy, when really being a good citizen is being a citizen that allows for debate within respectful framework.
And I think that's what Canada is all about. And I think that's the difference between Americans and Canadians so much, is that Canadians typically are more polite. We typically respect each other more, and we typically don't tend to run the hate politics that you see in American elections and American campaigns. And I think that's a good thing in Canada, not something that we want to dismantle and destroy.
Sure. And I would say by the same token that a lot of the hate we do experience here can often be a bit more insidious, which can make it more difficult to address as a social issue. And so that's something that we need to come to grips with. And once in a while, it bubbles to the surface in instances like the Eric Rosinsky case in the fall, where we see a clearly hate-motivated incident take place, or in issues like the recent debate around Ann Coulter and free speech versus hate speech. So, again, those things are more prominent debates. They're debates that are had in the U.S. quite frequently. But here, again, once in a while, we have these debates, but I think sometimes it's a bit more insidious, too, which is a problem, certainly.
Right. And just so that everybody gets it, what was that hate hotline again?
Sure. The hate helpline is 519-951-1584. Again, it operates Monday to Friday, 9 to 5, and people have an option to leave a message outside of the regular operating hours, and a helpline operator will return their call.
Wonderful. We're going to leave you with the final part of the Dr. Eric Fisher interview, and here's the rest of that now.
This stuff really isn't about logic. It's about emotion, and that's the other key to really understanding a lot of the stuff. There are seven protective emotions that I talk about. Those are anger, rage, arrogance, flippancy, defiance, sarcasm, and hatred. And every one of those emotions serves the purpose to protect us and our power. They hide emotions that are all seen as strong, but called bad and wrong, but they hide our feelings and emotions that feel weak, be it guilt or shame or inadequacy or fear or doubt. And what I do with people is I have a list of 260 emotions that I have, and when I do talks and things like that, I'll say, I want you to look for all those emotions, and I want you to check all the emotions off in that list that look weak. And in this list of 260 emotions, it might be that 200 of those emotions or more are seen as weak. So what happens is people don't want to show emotions that look weak. We want to hide them because we want to look as good and strong and right as possible. And that creates the problem that if I can use my strong emotions and protective emotions to justify not my weakness but my strength over you, the other person on the other side doesn't necessarily want to do that or know how to do that. It doesn't help solve problems. It only creates more problems. Like I said, he who screams loudest often is seen as the winner when it's just not true at all.
So when we talk about why the Free Speech Society brought Ann Coulter to Canada, she's American. She's an American liberalist. She talks about American politics, which aren't really relative to Canada in any way. She typically goes on stage and bashes minorities. She's stand-up comedy. She just preaches to the choir, and she fills an auditorium with, you know, like-minded, marginalistic people, and then makes them laugh and clap. And what is your take on the advantage of bringing a person to like that to Canada?
Like you said, she's going to bring a certain type of people that if you've got a product, and politics is a product. It's a product that you sell, and you have to gain customers, and you sell that product, you know, anything. Religion is a product. It's all about marketing and PR. And what they can do is if I bring in somebody that represents a product similar to mine, it doesn't have to be the same as, and then I bring my people in, then I can sell my product right along the side of that person because that person becomes my spokesperson in a way. And the thing about Ann Coulter is she's got a product to sell. You don't really know if behind closed doors that she really believes all that stuff, but all she knows is that she evokes emotion and gets a reaction and it's gained her popularity. We have a lot of people who, you know, the shock jocks and things like that, especially in the United States, that they want to evoke emotions and to get people to follow them, and they don't care if you like them or not. If they're selling product, if they're moving product, they're seen as successful. Because what we totally lack, and this can happen on both sides of the conservative and liberal fence, it happens all the time, is we lack integrity. Integrity is when our beliefs, our ideals, our morals, our values, and our behaviors all stand in alignment. And often they don't. And we don't want to acknowledge our loss in integrity because, you know, if you look at Ann Coulter and you look at her in interviews and you look at her body language screams insecurity. It screams discomfort. It screams perceived weakness inside that she's trying to hide. That's what people don't see. So why I'm screaming and yelling and saying all these shocking things, I don't want you to see the real me. I want you to see the ideal me. Because you'll buy the ideal me, or you'll vote for the ideal me, but I don't necessarily care if you like me. I don't care if I stand in integrity. I'm selling this product. So that's kind of the thing I see is how we all have our spokespeople. You know, I mean, look at what happened with Tiger after his whole adultery thing. He lost a lot of his endorsements because he was no longer the spokesperson that the product wanted. If Ann Coulter changed her message, or she had some wake-up time where she really saw what she was doing to people, she potentially might fear losing her customers. Once you set up an ideal image, it's very hard to change that image without needing to lose popularity, lose customers, lose what you've worked for. So that's where fear is often behind a lot of the people that create these images and sell these approaches to the world.
I compare Ann Coulter's visit to Canada, you know, they take and they fill a room full of like-minded people who clap and cheer at the marginalization of others and then put that on the media. Isn't that almost virtually the same thing as a group of schoolyard bullies standing around somebody, jeering at them and making them feel bullied?
Absolutely. It doesn't change when we grow up. A lot of people think that when we grow up, these things are going to go away, but they don't. You know, I mean, I work with a lot of people and kids and parents in the education system and schools, and I see how there's bullying from parents to the teachers. There's bullying from the teachers to the parents and the administrators to the parents. We've never learned how to behave differently. The schoolyard isn't just about what we learn in our books. The schoolyard is what we learn about how to behave in society. So that's where one of the things I also teach is the other model of power I talk about, which is an equity model of power. An equity model of power says that we're all equal in power, but we have different gifts, strengths, weaknesses, handicaps, wisdom, experience, knowledge, and understanding. And as we look to work towards those and we focus on ourselves, and from the beginning we might learn to love ourselves first, and then we'd automatically learn to love and respect other people. There's two types of respect between those two models. The first type of respect is what I say is a love-based respect in the equity model. It's, like I said, I'll love and respect myself, I'll love and respect you. Do unto others as you would have them do unto you, with that golden rule. There's a fear-based respect that underlies the hierarchical model, that control-based model. It says, I'll respect you as long as you have status and power over me, or as long as you can reach out and harm me, or as long as you're around. But as soon as you're not there, I have no respect for you as a person. And that's where I'll do whatever I darn well please when somebody who has no power isn't there anymore. And that creates a real problem, because we don't learn responsibility. We don't learn integrity. We don't learn honor. We learn to do whatever we can do to get ahead. And that's what feeds this problem, is we haven't learned the more equity-based ways to live our lives. And or people are more equity-based, they aren't war-based. They aren't about strong. They're about balance. They're about integrity. And they won't play the same game and go to the same lengths that people who are about hierarchy. And people who go into the hierarchy and say, well, I won the war. I'm great. I'm powerful. I'm successful. No. You just beat the heck out of people who didn't necessarily ask to have the heck beaten out of them. So that's where we have to look at how we define success, and how do we move our cultures and help them see the wisdom of moving from these more control-based cultures and hierarchical stuff to more equity-based. Because the core of the equity-based culture is love. The core of the hierarchical-based culture is fear. Everybody in a hierarchy feels afraid, even that proverbial big circle. Because if I'm the big circle, the smaller ones either need me to take care of them, or I'm responsible for the success, or they're gunning for me, trying to undermine my power because they want my power. Or there's always going to be a bigger circle somewhere around that can still crush me, whether it be God or whatever that may be. So they always have to watch their back. But a good bully knows how to divide and conquer. They know how to create fear in the minds of the people that want to follow them, and also fear in the minds of the people that oppose them. If I create fear in the people that follow me, then it's that, hey, I can turn on you in any moment, and what I'm doing to you, I can do to anybody else. You know, or what I'm doing to the other people, I can do to you. And what I'm doing to the other people, they just want them to fear and just go away, you know, and disappear so that they can get whatever they want. And that's a lot of what you see happening in this marginalization. They want the people who feel weak to just disappear in the background so that they can run whatever they want to run the way they want to run it.
So that brings us to solutions. And this is a continent we're talking about, not a playground.
Right.
And the variables are extreme, and the power and the power structures are multitude and confusing. So Canada has taken your rescuer approach, and they've set up a rescuer, which is a government agency, to solve the problem. What is your solution?
You have to wipe out those labels. In an equity model, there are no rescuers and victims and persecutors, because nobody needs rescuing. You teach empowerment. We have to acknowledge as adults that we have dysfunctional beliefs. Any part of change, what, you know, and we're addicted to this model. So this is a almost global addiction. The reason we don't change is because if we believe is if a culture we change, then other cultures are going to overrun us. The problem is if we don't change, other cultures are going to take off and leave us behind. And that's part of what I call cultural or collective arrogance. And arrogance is a protective emotion in that it's a shield of false pride. And we live on that false pride, and we buy that false pride, and we drink the Kool-Aid, and we all pull together and we say, look how great we are. The other cultures are working harder and working better and learning how to do it better. And look throughout history at the downfall of every empire throughout time has been arrogance. It hasn't been fear. Fear is at the core of arrogance. So what we have to do is first understand why our culture is dysfunctional and recognize it. And then we have to have the courage to say to our kids, we made a mistake and you guys are our future. And we need to really get in there and teach kids about power, about why we do what we do, and help them understand emotions. But to do that, then we have to understand emotions ourselves. And so many times I'm working with parents and families that they want to do better. They just don't know how. Our political system's no different. A lot of people really want to do better. They just don't know how, so they come from their right. And even if they don't want to change, often the reason they don't want to change is out of fear. So we have to help them to see that when we get stuck in fear, fear can immobilize us. So while fear helps to keep us alive and lets us know we need protection, it can also keep us stuck in the dark ages. And right now, I kind of see things that we're very dangerous because when you have an overpowering culture, similar going back to the dark ages, the power of the Catholic Church kept the world in Western and in Europe from developing. And we have potentially the issue is if we let this go and we don't learn to work this out, we're going to become in our own political dark age, and we're not going to grow and evolve. And that's why we have to really help each other and all wake up to see this, to learn to talk together, to learn conflict resolution skills, to learn to not to let people bully us, because we're not victims and we don't have to play rescuers. We want to empower everybody, from our kids all the way up to our constituents, to the people that feel marginalized, to say, you know what, you choose potentially to feel marginalized. You choose to feel that there's something wrong with you. There's something good and strong and right about all of us. And that's what we need to find, is the belief in ourselves. And that doesn't mean belief over people. It means the belief with people. And that's different than what we're taught when we're growing up in these cultures.
So I'm talking with Dr. Eric Fisher, who is long-term psychologist or psychotherapist, I guess.
Either term's great.
And publisher of two different books, one of which being The Art of Managing Everyday Conflict.
And Empowered Parenting, The Manual You Wish Your Kids Came With.
Oh, yes. I can't forget that one. It's a wonderful book that I'm going to read cover to cover myself. Thank you very much for coming on the show, Dr. E, and got a Facebook group. And what's your website?
The website is Dr. E Presents, which is DREPRESENTS.com. So DrEPresents.com. I've also got blogs on that and numerous articles on the internet.
Wonderful. Thank you very much for coming on the show. It's been insightful.
It's an absolute pleasure, and I appreciate the opportunity. Take care.
You've been listening to Between the Margins on CHRW 94.9 FM. I'm Michelle Boyce, and Gio's in the booth today. For more information about our show, check out our blog at www.betweenthemargins.ca. And remember, if you want to send me mail, make it respectful. Thanks to our guests, Dr. Eric Fisher, and Robin Wing, and of course Meredith Fraser from the Hate and Bias line here in London. Have a good day.